Hello, thank you for joining me today. I am Shelley Kino, host of Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not what we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. The caterpillar literally dissolves into cells and then reforms into a butterfly. And then it has to fight its way out of the cocoon in order to be strong enough to fly, to survive, and to just be the beautiful creature that we all see. And what I have seen as an author, as a special education teacher, and now as a special education advocate or coach, master IEP coach, is there are so many people breaking through those barriers all the time that there is no way that I could write enough books. And so I started this about a year and a half ago, and it is my pleasure to every week bring you someone who is busting through those limits, or sometimes I have organizations that are helping our friends bust through those limits. And today I have the pleasure of bringing someone who might be very familiar with Shakespeare's home because he comes from England, and he might live nowhere near it, but he's closer than we are here in the US. So Mark, thank you for joining me. I so appreciate you coming on today. This is my guest, Mark Webb. How are you?
Well, I'm very well, thank you. Yes, I don't personally know William Shakespeare.
I would hope not.
No, although I've just had my 53rd birthday, so I'm almost old enough to him, you know, minus 200-400 years or whatever it was.
Right.
I've been to his birthplace. I studied his literature. I saw a picture of him today, and that's as far as it goes.
Well, seeing a picture of him today is better than I have. I haven't seen a picture of him in a long time. But I, too, have had an opportunity to visit his birthplace. My husband was in the military when we first met and were married, and we were stationed in England for 3 years. And so we went down to Stratford-upon-Avon and just went as much as we could and visited as many different places. And our favorite area was the Cotswolds area. Yeah,
very, it's beautiful. Very special.
Yeah, it's just beautiful there. So tell our audience, and I always forget the business side of things. If you're watching, make sure you give it a thumbs up or you like it or you subscribe. You don't want to miss any of these episodes because they're all amazing. If you're watching hashtag, if you're watching live, give me a hashtag live. If you're watching replay, give me a hashtag replay. Okay, now tell me about who you are and what you do.
So, I'm talking to you. I'm just looking at the time. It's 7:05. So, having looked at my screen, I realize I've got, if I was really careful, if I moved to the right way, I could kind of look angelic or something, but that's kind of this evening lighting. So, my name is Mark Webb, and I have just celebrated a birthday a couple of years past 50. Because of that, how many people have you had drinking sparkly on a chat? But anyway,
I have not had any. You'll be the first.
How do I even start? So I've gone multiple, partly because I have developed a fairly icky disease called multiple sclerosis. And my multiple sclerosis is fairly advanced. So below you see a very handsome middle man who could easily pass for 21.
Absolutely.
I realize that, and it's very obvious that I'm just 20 or something. And below this is a wheelchair, and here'll be another first for you. This is my suprapubic catheter that leads to my bladder. So you've just seen a bag full of my wee. So I have quite advanced multiple sclerosis. And in that capacity, with those conditions, I am quite advanced, quite usually exhausted. I have become passionate about all things disability and diversity. Almost naturally, almost by evolution. And in work terms, I am head of communications for a charity called shift.ms. And although I come from the land of Shakespeare, roughly half our audience are in North America. So I'm always delighted to talk to somebody across the sea. Yeah. I blog at onemanandhiscatheters.com, and I trust from my introduction that you understand that I try to be transparent and a little bit more open than some others dare to be about their condition. I podcast at Disability at the Table, which is all about why aren't disabled people more professionally present, because I'm sure it's a statistical fact over in the US as well, but certainly in the UK we are more likely to be unemployed, we are going to be less paid when and if we find jobs. So it's about talking to successful people. And I know you've had Victoria from Unhidden Clothing on.
Yes.
Roughly a month ago. And I've just done a podcast with her, and she's got some fairly icky, icky being a very English non-existent word, but not unpleasant disabilities, and is thriving as an entrepreneur. Being in communications, I work in everything diversity with the PRCA, which is the PR body. And in my spare time, I'm definitely in love with my wife. I've got two kids and I play wheelchair rugby very, very badly.
And something that I promoted this episode about today is your sense of humor. I have not met you until maybe 10 minutes before this show started. But the things that you post on LinkedIn, which is how I connected with you, are funny. You have a great sense of humor just on those kinds of things. And so I do fully expect to laugh frequently. No pressure, though, during this episode.
I started off with campaigning about multiple sclerosis. That turned into campaigning about disability, and that almost naturally turned into campaigning about diversity. And we all want change and equality and equity now. And what I do point out to people is that I don't know how familiar you are with the story of the suffragette movement in the UK. That was our movement for women to get the vote. And I often remind people that was, roughly 100 years since a woman literally martyred herself, ran out in front of a horse race in the UK, which was filmed and died being trampled by the horses to win the vote. And we got the vote then, also before I was born there. But, we still haven't got equality on pay or existence on the FTSE 100, which is like the Fortune 500, is it?
Uh-huh.
We're still not there. So I believe in the necessity for people to chain themselves to gateposts and sadly run in front of horses 100 years ago. And we've got a climate change campaign going on where some people are super gluing themselves to our famous motorway around around London. Wow. Now there is a place in society for that, but there's also a place for positive campaigning and laughter. And it partly grabs the attention. You may go on to talk about my awful clothing habits. I chose not to dress badly tonight. You may go on to talk about my awful clothing habits, but it's another way of getting attention. And much as communication channels have moved on, from let's get in the newspapers, let's say only 20 years ago, to social media and YouTube and how much has the world changed in communications in these times? Humor and a bit of nonsense is a powerful tool.
It really is. And there are a lot of things that in American culture, at least, we have made fun of that were very serious topics, but because we were making fun of them in our sitcoms and whatnot, it opened up discussion. And I do think that comedy leads to people being able to get a little bit more comfortable with those things that they're uncomfortable with. And then maybe having a little bit of thinking going behind that, like, yeah, okay, I laughed at that, but is that really funny? Or why did I think that was funny? And, you know, having that change of their own perspective. And honestly, that's what I am hoping is the outcome of hashtag no limits, is that people will think about how they approach another person or how they think about hiring a person with a disability or just in their own mindsets. We have these things called cognitive biases, and I won't go into the full detail of them, but we all develop them and most of them are wrong. But it's just the way that our brain processes all the bits of information that we get every single minute, and it puts it in these different categories. And from there, we build these biases. And I want people's biases to be challenged of, okay, well, this is what I thought, but now I'm seeing this person on Shelley's show and they're able to do this and this and this and this, or they're living a life that like this and this and this that I didn't expect. And so trying to get that conversation going and just exposing, like I said, in my intro, and I don't know that you, if you even know this about me, but I wrote this book and it was released almost a year ago, Those Who Can't Teach. And it's 9 true stories of special needs families. And I know when I talked to Victoria, she's like, oh, I cringe when I hear special needs, but that was a lot of thought behind it. And we talked to several people and I know that, you know, the language there, but anyway, beyond that, it's to promote acceptance, inclusion, and empathy. And it's like I said in the intro, their stories in this book are not all that unusual, but their stories aren't out there. So I'm hoping that with that book and with this program, lives will be changed, hearts will be changed, and then behaviors and attitudes will be changed.
Well, well done for getting a book out. I plowed through, I think I'm 70,000 words in, but I've been those 70,000 words in for about 4 years.
Yeah, and that's big enough. It really is, because they say first-time authors is like 40,000.
I need to push on through, because I have a fun story to tell. I've lived such a blessed life, I've had so much fun, and it's been brilliant, and it's been in very different phases, which perhaps we'll talk about. But I'd love to tell it and put it down and make people think, because we all, what do we dream of when we're children? In, you know, when you're young, you think you're going to be an astronaut or a fireman or a soldier or whatever. And it rarely turns out as you dream, but it doesn't mean that that's bad. You know, I still quite fancy, I'd love to be the first disabled person in space, my word.
But, oh, wow.
Dreams often don't turn out where you expect them to. And actually, when I'm talking to children, you talked about special needs children, but I think children are having a really rough ride these last couple of years with what's been going on. But when I am talking to them, I'm called on to talk about resilience and the future. I'm often very keen to point out that basically, and what most people expect, is they haven't any job that they expect to do. It probably hasn't been invented yet. And what a great future they might have the world develops at pace.
Yeah, that's a really neat thought to think of it that way. I hadn't heard of that, you know, that's very, very possible that their jobs haven't even been invented yet. So you said that you developed MS, multiple sclerosis. So can you kind of walk us through like what your life was like before and kind of some of the symptoms that you started to notice and then getting the diagnosis and what that felt like and what that did to you mentally and physically as well?
Yes, of course. I think about my life in roughly 3 phases. So I was one of those annoyingly gifted children. So I don't know what the equivalent is in the US, but I was head boy at a top school head boy is the one who's nominated by teachers as to be the kind of representative. I was captain of rugby, which I know is not that popular a sport in the US, dagnabbit, but it was, I was that. I scored highly in exams without trying. I got all the girls. It was, I was a bit of a disgrace in an annoying kind of way. And I went on without really knowing, almost as a result of being so lucky, I went on without knowing what I was going to do in my life. So I then spent some time abroad working in ski resorts, working in holiday resorts, with most of the objective being get the girl and get the beer, not necessarily in that order, vaguely attended university, but with no intent. And during university, a certain theme park east of Paris, run by a 4-foot mouse, opened in 1992. And partly because I'd been looking after tourists, I think, and because I was, I always try and find the right words that would translate, but smarmy being the wrong side of charming. Anyway, I was smarmy. So I was put in charge of looking after celebrities in 1992 at the opening. And when you open a Disney theme park in any new continent, my word, you get your A-listers. So I looked after a couple of people you might have heard of, George Bush Sr., President Mitterrand, Michael Jackson, Kevin Costner, Clint Eastwood, Gloria Estefan, my favorite.
And the only female you've mentioned so far.
Sorry?
I said I'm the first female you've mentioned.
Yes. Oh, my word. If I could remember some of your daytime commentators that I looked after. It was funny meeting American celebrities I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And having to know that they were incredibly famous, but right. So I had this wonderful time, which did a couple of things. One, it exposed me to media. They were always being interviewed by TV or radio or journalists, and that's how I became what I did become in my career. You know, PR, that's public relations. So getting the companies I worked for into the newspapers when they wanted to be in the newspaper and keeping them out when they didn't want to be. But secondly, when I look retrospectively, 1992, while I was running around thinking I was oh so important, my first MS symptoms. So the first symptoms were pins and needles down my left-hand side, really intense. I called them nails and needles. They were so intense. For 3 solid days, then they went, and I did nothing about them, being a 24-year-old
man.
And I ignored it. I convinced myself in retrospect that I'd had a minor stroke, and of course, if you have a stroke, you do go running to the hospital. So to have done nothing about it was a little bit ridiculous, but it did turn out to have been multiple sclerosis. I then, not long after that, developed bladder problems. But the French at that time weren't that brilliant at using loos. So I did a lot of popping behind trees and visiting gate posts and whatever. Thinking there was some kind of male secret society that did occasionally wet themselves or have to go running for it. Right. So again, didn't consult anybody. Then I developed a rather unpleasant thing that when you are busy chasing girls called erectile dysfunction. In the UK, to translate it here, I'd call it floppy willy. And then I did talk to a doctor. The blue pill.
Because then it was important.
So, yes, but suddenly my world was falling apart. I did consult a doctor, the blue pill was on the verge of being invented, but it hadn't. So I had an injection into you know where. It was proved to be functioning, and they said, "Well, it's all in your head." In a sense, it was, because multiple sclerosis is. is the your own autoimmune condition attacking the brain and your spine, and the nerves that get infected or get attacked by your own immune system are the ones that dictate where you have problems. So I'm afraid they said it's all in your head, which it kind of was.
Little did they know they didn't know what they were talking about. Yeah.
Off I went.
Yeah, little did they know. They knew they were giving the right diagnosis, but not technically either. Yeah.
Yes, and I carried on with that and sort of dealt with it fell madly in love with my wife in 1999. She also worked for Disney, but another entity, the Disney Stores. Oh no, sorry, she worked for gaming at the time, so video games, but then worked for Disney Store. We met in a Disney Synergy meeting. It's as if Disney actually invented Synergy. It was almost instant. Certainly my love for her, my adoration for her, less so for her. She didn't notice me at first and then thought I was gay. So I didn't really have that impact, but we got there. And from January, first kiss in 1999, we were married in December 1999. So 11 months. It was a fast track and it was wonderful. And my purpose from being that awful, charming but a little bit obnoxious bloke, I became this dedicated, in love man. We've got two children, a 15-year-old and an 11-year-old, and really I had that sort of second phase of my life where I found purpose in just being, trying to be a good husband, and dedicating my life to being a professional as opposed to a drinky woman chasing whatever
playboy.
And my symptoms were creeping up on me. So I was working for a health and fitness chain, which won't have been heard of in the US, but it was a premium one. Every year I was doing a triathlon, and every year I was stumbling on my left leg, which in retrospect turns out to be what they call foot drop. But because it was once a year and then went away, I kind of forgot about it.
Right.
Just rubbish. Then joined a company called Dixon's, which is a little bit like Best Buy, so an electrical retailer. I joined in 2006, and 2007 there were so many dots that finally I was joining up. And after going to my general practitioner, so my local doctor, I was sent to a neurologist, as in a head doctor, and a urologist, as in a waterworks doctor. And after about a 3 or 4 month process of elimination and various tests, including a couple of MRI scans, that's where you go into that big white chamber and things buzz into your head, just all sorts of tests, the worst being the spinal tap, the lumbar puncture. Oh my word, that was horrible. And they said, you've got multiple sclerosis. Didn't know what that was, really. It was, was that ME? Was that Parkinson's? Although it didn't mean a lot to me. So you asked, after my very long answer here, what my reaction was. It was a little bit of numbness. It was a little bit of consulting Dr. Google and deciding I had 10 minutes to live because of that. Really a bit of denial. There are the five stages of grief, which I know a lot of people talk about. And I think those stages of grief have been disproven to be anything scientific, but they are a very good guide to what people went through. So I never really went through the anger bit, but I certainly went through the denial. I went through some numbness, whatever. And I just kind of gone on with life in the short term. Dixon's were brilliant with me. Sorry, equivalent, let's call it Best Buy.
Yeah.
And the equivalent of Best Buy, Dixon's were brilliant with me. And I went away from those sort of for about 2 weeks to feel sorry for myself at home and acclimatize with my wife. Our first child had just been born. And by the time I came back, the whole team had educated themselves about what MS was or is.
Wow.
And I got this wonderful sense of support emotionally from the team. And one of the phrases or words I talk about is allyship. You know, I campaign for diversity and people to be more aware of disability, et cetera, et cetera. There's not a lot you can teach to people about just doing the right thing. And they did.
Yeah.
And that was so helpful in the early stages of my diagnosis, even though actually in retrospect, I'd had MS for 15 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, in essence, you've really had it with some symptoms, just very mild, for about 30 years.
Yes. And MS is sometimes called the snowflake disease. Snowflakes being unique in that every single person will have a different flavor of multiple sclerosis. And we have this whole smorgasbord, this whole huge menu of symptoms we can cut, or our body or our brain can right. kind of choose from. And so none of us will be the same. So there was a bit of that male denial of for many years of what was going on. But at the time, there wouldn't have been much intervention at the anyway. It's only now that the philosophy, the neurological approach is to really attack anybody who's got MS with some quite aggressive treatments. So there's no cure for MS. It's a cure. It's a disease for life. It's progressive, and mine has gone quite aggressively downhill. There are worse in the world with MS by a long chalk, but there's a lot of people are better off than me. And anybody diagnosed now, there's a lovely phrase from a US doctor called Aaron Boster. He says, we want to make MS boring. And by that, he means what he's implying there is there probably won't be a cure anytime soon. But we are on the verge of saying, oh, you've got a diagnosis with MS. OK, we know how to treat it so that you can carry on with life. So it's OK. I've got a pretty unpleasant disease now, but I feel very positive about the future for people with MS.
So how long after the diagnosis did you end up in the wheelchair all the time? Or are you in it all the time? Are you able to get up and walk around, or do you have to have...
So there's a phrase I want to stress and shout about here. I'm a wheelchair user, not wheelchair bound, because bound implies some negativity about a wheelchair. Do you know who invented the wheelchair, by the way?
As soon as you say the name, I'll go, oh, yeah, I knew that. But no, off the top of my head, I cannot.
No, it won't make any sense to you. It was Charles Darwin. So Charles Darwin, as in the evolutionary chap.
Right.
He just wanted to scoot around his office quicker. So he invented the first rolling chair. But anyway, I always want people to realize that, it enables me. It gets me around. It keeps me mobile. It keeps me out with my family within limits. Of course, I'm never going to, talking about ambitions. I'm pretty confident I'm not going to climb Mount Everest, but I can still do stuff. And that's because of a wheelchair. And you are not leg bound. I'm a wheelchair user who can walk a few yards. I did 60 meters on a treadmill yesterday. My legs are exhausted today, but it's that lovely feeling of exercise well done. So I can walk a few meters. I have a rollator, a walker, in the olden days it was called a Zimmer frame to get me around. But basically, I'm more often than not a wheelchair user, and that probably started about, let's say, 5 years ago, roughly speaking.
Okay.
I went from there's a journey. You go from walking stick to crutches to rollator to wheelchair. In that time, you know, let's go back to career briefly. It attacks. I've got the physical stuff. I don't worry. I won't show you my urine bag again. But you know, there's some fun going on down there. My lower limbs are pretty awful. My right fingers are probably 9 out of 10. My left fingers probably 6 out of 10. So I'm getting attacked all over the place, mm-hmm. but I'm also getting attacked cognitively and fatiguely. That's not a word, but let's use it. Fatiguely.
Yep, it makes sense to us.
So I 2007 diagnosed. By about 2009, I was starting to not be able to cope with the heavy demands of a full-time into London, few drinks with journalists, long hours, funny phone call times from journalists, dealing with grumpy chief executive officers, etc. So I was called into a room, and it was what I call what I feared was going to be the guilty check moment, when they say, there, Mark, you're a bit rubbish now, so have a bit of money and get out of here. And that was absolutely not what happened. So I was with the group HR director, so the most human, most senior human resources person, and my boss, who was the corporate affairs dude. And they both said, Mark, you're not coping. This was all said so well, so that's probably not a good way of saying it, but you're not coping. We love you. What can we do that will build you a job that will work for you, you know, with your condition, but will work with us as a company? And social media was growing in importance. Our CEO happened to be on Twitter. Not many chief executive officers are on Twitter. And I was starting to tweet to the same journalists who I used to be talking to on the phone and meeting with in London, etc. So we decided to make me head of groups or corporate social media. And working from that, I could work from bed on a bad day. I could work from home frequently. I could work effectively in the hours that worked for me. I could nag my chief exec to tweet when he wasn't tweeting very well. We turned him into the most followed Twitterer on the FTSE one of the CEOs on the FTSE 100. So like the Fortune 500. So it was a job that worked for me, worked for the company, and allowed me to carry on, as opposed to sending me off into the sunset or making me, you know, chief photocopier or something like that. So a wonderful transition that a major company with 42,000 employees at the time and dominant in Europe, rather like Best Buy is in the US, just brilliant. And it's almost a shame I have to flag them out as you know, an exception, because they were an exception. And back to that point about disabled people being employed less, paid less, I need to keep flagging them up. And I've got no shares with them. I left 4 or 5 years ago, and I still talk them up. I'm still this ultimate employee advocate. That's a phrase that I use, because they were brilliant with me.
Yeah. And as you were speaking, that is exactly what I was thinking, is the fact that we had, you know, I say we, but it's important that we talk about that, because that's truly how every company should be. But they are such a rarity that it is so important to say, here is the standard. All the rest of you need to come up. And unfortunately, this is so rare up here. This is so prevalent. And, you know, again, hopefully things like your podcast, things like what we're doing here today, my book, and things that Victoria is doing, and all the entrepreneurs with disabilities and all the people that are out, you know, doing the advocacy like what we're doing, will start to change that. and get that momentum going, because it is so important. As a person, you're valuable. Period. Yeah, there's no.
Thank you. That's very kind. And you know, I have to be careful. There's a certain company starting with A that delivers quite a few packages to many homes.
Uh-huh.
And I have to be careful because I've done a speech to some of their team. But the rumor has it that they paid some of their warehouse staff to sort of tweet and say nice things about them. And I think that's the and it's only rumor. So let's be careful.
Right.
And yeah, they've been a godsend to me in lockdown because I couldn't go out. I was isolating. I'm at risk from, you know, that thing that maybe hopefully we won't talk about too much.
Right.
So, you know, they've been a godsend to me, and, you know, long live successful companies that employ lots of people. But paying people to say nice things about you is the wrong way of going about employee advocacy. What you want is people who are genuinely proud of your of the work that they get to do with you, of the way that you're treated as a human being. It doesn't have to be, you know, I use this word provocatively, but it's, you know, a cripple. That was the old word for,
right,
I think handicapped is still quite prevalent in the US, but disabled is kind of the word, certainly in the UK. But, you know, we've gone from crippled to handicapped to disabled. It doesn't have to be just disabled people you look after, but every flavor of diversity, and your standard employee who doesn't have any of those issues or biases to talk about. They're your ambassadors if you just go above and beyond just a tiny bit. You know, there was nothing miraculous about what the Dixons did for me. It was just great and human.
Yeah, and it's that relationship. And I understand in a big corporation, you know, that it is more difficult for the CEOs and the whole C-suite of executives to have relationships with their employees. But to remember that their employees are not just numbers, that they are people. And, you know, as a former teacher, something that I teach teachers now is have a relationship with every student, whether they're actually one of your own students or not. I was a special education teacher, so I had a small population that I considered my students, but I knew most every student in the district. It was a small district, so that was a lot easier. But I mean, I still see people today from that district that I was in for a decade, and hey, Mrs. Kino, how are you doing? And they'll still remember me. And it's just a matter of, and oftentimes just making eye contact and just letting that person know that they're seen and that you appreciate their being on earth, basically.
Absolutely. You know, back to me being my annoying self when I was younger, too gifted, too lucky, maybe some arrogance, I don't know. I like to think I never did anything bad. But I was a nice guy, but I didn't do the empathy thing. And that's what I've learned through experience and loving my wife and loving my children, and particularly now dealing with minorities. And I do point out that the disabled minority is actually the largest minority. That almost doesn't matter, because I care. I want ethnicity to be pulled out and championed, sexuality, age. Now I'm over 50, you know, and social mobility as well. You know, when I've really started to delve into diversity, one of the awful things is, you know, that there's very different across the world, different ways of dealing with class. But the fact it generally remains, if you're born poor, you're going to not be educated that well. You're going to struggle to rise up against the situation you were born into. If you happen to know people and your dad was a fairly successful entrepreneur or ran this business or that business, you're probably going to end up a little bit better off with your own career, whatever your abilities. So social mobility as well. I just want the world to change for the better for all of those groups.
Right. Yeah. And that is, it's so true that, you know, all across the world, and I'll probably make some of my viewers a little upset here, but we are so spoiled and blessed in the United States, especially. My husband and I have had the privilege of going other places in the world, and we've seen what other places are like. And so to hear people in the U.S. complain so much about what we don't have or what they think they don't have sometimes annoys me. I'll be perfectly honest, because I think if you could just broaden your viewpoint. And I know when you're down, you know, it does. It feels like you're never going to get out of it. But we have so many opportunities in the US, in the UK, that so many countries just dream about.
Yes. And that's, again, gosh, how many, if we did buzzword bingo on what I say, I think we'd win on the word diversity. But I'm very aware that, you know, I've got a very advanced disability and probably one of the cruelest major diseases out there. The suicide rate because depression is prevalent in those of us with MS, we have more suicides than statistically than cancer or epilepsy or Parkinson's or motor neurone disease. That's the one that kills people off within 3 or 4 years, unless you're this tiny minority like Stephen Hawking. So it's a disease that really does impact the brain. But anyway, I've, touch wood, lucked out there. I'm fine. I'm a happy chappy. But I am aware that much as though I've got a very big disability and I get pity, I don't want pity, but anyway, I get all that, I'm still white, privileged, middle class in a prosperous country. And I never forget, well, I try never forget that, he says, reaching for a glass of sparkly for his birthday.
Which, happy belated birthday, by the way. I don't think I've said that this episode, so I want to be sure to bring that up. So yeah, I want to talk about something that you mentioned before, just a little bit ago, about you walked on the treadmill. When you did that, I believe you posted a little bit about it on LinkedIn.
I did.
And I think it said it was an anti-gravity treadmill, or is it like,
yes. So, that's thank you. You're a very good interviewer. Did you know that?
Oh, thank you very much. I'll try not to break my arm patting myself on the back.
Sorry. While we're talking. So I'm getting multitasking is not a very male thing anyway. And with MS, because your brain is messed up, it's really difficult to multitask. I'm just going to be talking, trying to distract you from the fact I'm emptying my catheter bag into a jug. So there's another first. Okay. How many firsts am I going to achieve?
I know. We've had at least 3 or 4 now. So
during this podcast, during this interview. Yes. So technology is, so medicine tends to take an awful long time to move forward. And you read about, and we have publications in the UK, and I bet you have some similar ones in the US, that print stories about these happy mice who've been cured of XYZ. And suddenly decide that, you know, everybody's going to be cured of everything. And actually translating a cured experimental mouse into a trial drug that passes effectiveness trials, then goes mass trial and statistically might not work for humans at all. We're talking about 15 years that until a trial happy mouse becomes something that will treat MS or cancer or motor neurone disease or whatever. Technology is moving so much faster than that. So I have a couple of pieces of technology that are still, no, let's talk about three. I have three great pieces of technology that help me. So first of all, that treadmill, of course it's not anti-gravity, but essentially it's a normal treadmill, which I put on a very not sexy pair of kind of rubber shorts that sort of surround, I could almost be going kinky there, couldn't I? around my body, and then they've got a zip on. You zip into a big frame that is airtight, and they blow air into the treadmill so that it can lift you up to 80% of your body weight can be taken off.
Wow.
And in front of you, standard treadmill, but with this kind of horse thing going on that's all filled up with air and lifts you up, in front of you is a view of your feet, you know, in my case, my rubbish feet. So I can watch how my very, not very well legs are working and be talked to by my physio, who is off, not right now, but imagine it, she's off to my right. She's sure. Looking at my legs from the side because it's plastic see-through siding. So she can tell me exactly where I'm initiating muscles that I haven't initiated for ages. And it's an amazing piece of kit, just not just for people with MS, for example, to experience standing and to reignite muscles that the nerves, because it's my nerve damage that's happened in MS,
right,
that the muscles haven't been talking to. So it's just a wonderful sensation and a lovely sense of, you know, almost, let's say, false achievement, but I guess you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's a brilliant piece of kit to exercise and for my mental and physical well-being. I've got I'm not sure if you can call any wheelchair sexy, but I've got as sexy a wheelchair as you could have, made by a Formula One, as in like a racing driver designer.
Yeah.
And he was at a local airport and saw a child with a very ugly power wheelchair, as in motorized wheelchair, and thought, well, that child, so he had no reason to develop this, but he just thought that child deserves better. And he's developed a fantastic wheelchair, motorized chair that has the big wheels at the front, motorized, and little at the back. And I can go off-road. I can go on the snow. I can go in sand, so on the beach. I can go into the woods with my children. Sometimes I topple over because I get a bit too carried away. But that's very expensive, and hopefully the price will come out down in time. But that was crowdfunded for me, so paid for me by friends. So £11,000. What's that? $15,000, something like that.
Pretty. More than that, I think.
Yeah. Possibly. So really expensive. And finally, and I think something that will really kick in almost literally in the next few years, is I've got a soft exoskeleton around my leg, not this second, but I can put on my legs that is powered by, that it's attached by Velcro, and it then pumps in air pressure into my legs. So it does two things. One, it again ignites muscles and parts of my body that really haven't got used to. I'm doing all the motions with my hand and touching my legs here, which is really not great TV. It ignites bits of my leg that haven't been talked to by my nerves. Yeah. And secondly, because it's quite powerful air that's gone in there, it also gives me a semblance of support. So I can go back to walking a few yards with my walker, just exhale, tootling up and down my corridor. So technology, again, gosh, I'm giving long answers here, aren't I? But
that's perfect, though. That's exactly what I want.
But essentially, my feeling is that much as though medical advances have to happen and will happen, and it's amazing what with AI and other pharmaceutical developments, that'll be great, but I think technology will help many more of us quicker.
Yeah, and I'm so excited for all of those devices and for you to have an opportunity to talk about them, because that is one of the reasons that this is called hashtag no limits, because we have no idea. Kind of like you said before, you know, jobs haven't even been invented for our children of today. But yep. having the thoughts, the imagination, the courage, whatever it is that helps people and drives people to come up with these inventions. I get so excited by things like that, but that also makes my frustration a little higher too at the people who want to place those limits and say, well, this person will never do this, or this person will never accomplish this, or this person will never be happy. I hate that word happy. I don't, but I mean, because everyone's version of happy is different. So to say that because someone isn't going to live the life that you have that makes you happy, they must not be able to be happy because it's not what you think it should be. So in that's the regard that I don't like the word happy because of all the different definitions of it.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It's a point I've already made, but I just feel so blessed. And sometimes I think that's unfair on my family because I know the limits I impose on them because there's plenty of things we can't do. But I do try and look at what I can do, mm-hmm. what I can do for others, and what the future holds. And these technology advances means that there's very few limits. And again, when I'm talking to children, I think we should all be worried about, sorry, I don't want to get too political because, you know, I have a broad church. You don't have to have a certain political leaning to have multiple sclerosis, for example. And I want everybody with multiple sclerosis or disability to feel better. But, you know, climate change is a very powerful story that a lot of us have feelings about. I actually feel, I know we've got people like Greta Thunberg and other such campaigners saying quite angry things. And, you know, I think most people acknowledge that we do need to make change. I'm kind of feeling that technology might help us out more. I think that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be striving to be better people and more recycling more and whatever. But I do think technology might find some ways round for us in a few years' time. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So something that you said, and I want to touch on it. You said that the things, you know, that you feel the limits that because of your MS are placed upon your family. I don't think it's limits. You have just given your family the opportunity to pivot and find other ways and other things to enjoy and experience. There are things that I know my friends who are wheelchair users I'm getting better. and that's the other thing I like about this show is I get, you know, I don't think I have those biases and I don't think I, you know, have those limitations with my words, but then I find out that I can word things differently or I can think a little bit differently. But you know, I just think there's so many opportunities that those of us who think a certain way actually miss out on than like yourself and your family who have to look around that straight path and find ways to enjoy and do. I just think there's so much more out there that, you know, it can be available to us if we would just look at it from someone else's perspective and just give a new glance at different things and new opportunities.
Yeah. No, thank you that's exactly the approach I should have. There's, you know, for all the rosiness that I'm painting, there is always, and it goes in waves. There is a sense of guilt that I have that,
sure.
And I know it's not my fault, but there remains a sense of guilt about what I do to close family and to family and close friends. And often I think it's tougher on my wife than on me, which is weird because I'm in fairly constant pain. I've got a blooming tube out of my tummy. I fall on the floor. I struggle to sleep. I struggle to stay awake. Everything. But I just think that, you know, I know she, well, I hope she loves me. She loves me. And it must be so tough to watch. And there's nothing I can do about it except strive to be the best that I can be. But it is tough to shift the guilt.
Yeah. And I imagine that it has to be. I mean, I've known, you know, myself when I've gone through very minor experiences of, you know, having to recover from a surgery or something like that, where I have to depend on my family for a very, very small amount of time. But I do think it tends to be harder on the caregiver sometimes, because, and I've been the caregiver too. So I've played both roles, that you can't do anything. And I think that makes it harder. You know, we listen to you say, you know, well, I'm experiencing a 7 on a 10 scale of pain, or I'm experiencing, you know, this or that. And because we can't do anything to physically make that better for you sometimes as caregivers, I think that's where mentally it wears on a caregiver. And so, yeah, I see both sides of what you're talking about, because I can only imagine truly, and probably not even really imagine, what it's like to be the care receiver so frequently.
Yeah. And thank you. But sorry, this is going to be not, I'm not going to pull you up on this, but I just want to make the point that you've probably, you know, you've looked after special needs children. And I think that takes a special type of person to do that. You've had you call them minor operations. It's not a competition.
I know.
We all have challenges we deal with. It sounds like a misery story, but my wife and I, we managed to burn Nell flat down in Paris in our first year of courting before we got married. We lost everything except for the clothes we were wearing and some daffodils we had bought back for the flower boxes in the window. So, you know, that could be a horrible tragedy. And it felt tough at the time, but it taught us a lot about the value of physical things. Didn't matter. Right. We were alive and we loved each other. Boom. I was diagnosed with MS. We've covered that in detail. My sister passed away 4 years ago. And what wins in the competition? It's quite obviously that's my son. My son is in snacking mode. I saw him just looking behind the camera. We all have our hardships to deal with, and they all seem horrible at the time. And I'm not trying to outdo anyone with, oh golly, Mark is so brave because he does his MS so well, blah, blah, blah. Everybody has tough times. I think it's the lessons we take from them rather than I hurt more than you. Whatever. Yeah. I probably haven't been very clear there, but I think we all have tough times. We all have brains that cope with different things in different ways. I've lucked out that way.
Yeah. And that's an incredibly valid point. And my saying about my surgery was just to kind of compare, as far as I'm not going through what the care receiving every day that you are. So I probably really can't fathom and imagine, you know, the daily weight that carries. But I appreciate what you said, because everyone does go through things. And that's another great way to look at the situation of hashtag no limits is we're all dealing with something. And it is right. You're right. It's not a competition. And that's, again, think about whatever it is that you as an individual are dealing with, and use that to remind yourself that you can do lots of things, and so can the person next to you. No matter what the differences are between the two of you, you have a lot more similarities.
Yes, no, absolutely. There's a treatment that's kind of unproven. You're probably aware of pharmaceutical trials, which go through different phase one, phase two, phase three, and they're what they call double blind. So neither the applier of the medicine or the treatment or the technology or whatever, or the person receiving it knows what they're going. Is it a placebo or the real thing until it happens? And there's a treatment, hyperbaric oxygen, where you sit in an oxygen chamber. It's like a deep sea diving or recovery bends chamber. So you sit in a pressurized to four, like 30 feet, but underwater in a pressurized chamber, breathing pure oxygen. And the theory of it is that you have oxygen pumped into your veins more than would normally get in there. And that's supposed to have curative powers. But because it's very difficult to double blind test, and because a pharmaceutical company is very unlikely to invest in it, nobody really knows for sure. But anyway, long story short, I've sat in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber because it's believed to help with our fatigue. Certainly feels like that helps with me. It's supposed to help people with their bladder. I'm not sure it helped me with that. But it's also used for cancer survivors, not for their cancer, but to help them recover from their chemotherapy or other aggressive treatments. Right. And I've been sitting, and five people can sit in there, slightly less if we're all bumbling in with wheelchairs. But I've been sitting there, and I've known that I'm looking at the cancer survivor thinking, oh, blimey, because, of course, they've often lost their hair, looking pretty grim. And I'm looking very disabled because I'm very physically look disabled. And I know I'm looking at them thinking, God, I'm so glad I haven't had your cancer. And I know they're looking at me, oh, God, I'm so glad I haven't got your MS. It's just the human capacity to cope. Sometimes we can't cope. And again, I don't want to sound all glib because I happen to be smiley, but the human capacity for coping with hardship is immense. And I think our incapacity is we can't put ourselves in other people's shoes as well. I'd love to solve every issue. I'd love to understand every issue. I can't. I just want to.
Yeah, exactly. I feel that way too. If we could, like you said earlier, just make the world a better place for everybody. You know, yes. And that's actually kind of my tagline on my stationery and such. When I do my reports for families, that they ask me to look at their child's IEP, which is an individualized education program. It's the document that guides our special education here in the U.S. And that's my thing, is I'm making the world, or my hope is that I'm making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Yes. We can't change everybody at once. But if we can change one person's approach, and then another person another day, and then, you know, what you're doing with your podcast, which we really didn't have a chance to get into too much about what you talk about on there and the guests that you have. And you did mention, and I would like you to mention it again before we need to wrap up here in just a little bit, but I do want you to mention again, you know, how people can find you and follow you and listen to your podcast. Because I'm sure that you share your humor in your podcast as well as you have done here today. And you did make me laugh a few times today. So thank you. You lived up to the pressure. I so appreciate that you did that. And we did have a guest join us. I mean, not a guest. We had an audience member, Michael. Michael complimented me, and I wanted to thank him for that. When you said that I was a good interviewer, he said he's one who watches me frequently. And so he said he agrees with you that I'm a good interviewer, and I appreciate both of you for that compliment. But yeah, so give us some wrapped up information here. Make sure that you cover how people can find you, how people can find your podcast, the title of it again. And then if there's any last, like, oh, I just wanted to make sure that I said this. Just weighing on your mind. Now's the time to do it.
Oh, my word. So blog. Thank you for that wrap up. So onemanandhiscatheters.com is my blog, where you would also find links to, and I must post that today. Thank you for my reminder. I podcast at Disability at the Table. That's relatively new. And that's really about professional people showing how, despite, in inverted commas, despite disability or either personal or experience of disability, how they can thrive and help people, because I do want to change stigmas. I tweet far too often, and my Twitter feed is at markweb_, double B, not World Wide Web, so markweb_. I probably don't Instagram enough, at markweb99, and I've just been signed up to be on the shadow board. So it's a voluntary position, but with some amazing people, to support a new agency called Reflect. And you can find it on LinkedIn, called Reflect the Agency. And it's all about reflecting the genuinely diverse population we have, and not just the white privileged one that I'm a part of. So that's an agency I'm going to be very proud to be helping launch, and see more representation in the media of all those funky diversities out there. Disability at the Table podcast, and this amazing charity, which, though we started it in a town called Leeds 11 years ago, north in the north of England, shift.ms. Actually has half its members in North America now. Mm-hmm. We've got over 40,000 members. It's a support network for all those impacted by multiple sclerosis, the majority of whom actually have multiple sclerosis. And it's a brilliant charity. And it's all that's good about social networks, because it's a supportive one.
That is fabulous. So is there any last bit of inspiration or any last thing that you want to say to make us laugh before we wrap up?
No, I did. Oh gosh, there you put the pressure on, as if I could tell a knock-knock joke then or something. So no, I am just going to say something we're all feeling. I don't like the world going a little bit tribal at the moment. So I know what's going on in the US. We're angry about this party and this party. We're angry about Brexit over here. We're angry about the pandemic. And it all feels a bit miserable sometimes. And there's a saying that I thought it came from Tom Hanks, but when I Googled it, it's actually a Persian saying. And I just love him for bringing it to my attention. And it's, "This too shall pass." And I think we'll be in better sunny uplands at some point somewhere. Don't know. Sometimes I despair a little, but we will. So thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Or whoever said it. Yeah. I thought it was in the Bible. So it tells you what I know.
Well, there you go. Well, of course I just used, again, Dr. Google. So who knows? Yeah. Maybe you're right. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Mark, for agreeing to be on today. It has been an absolute delight to speak with you. I'm so excited for everything that you are doing and everything that will be coming up in your future endeavors with the shadow board and the other things that you mentioned. Have a great, I know your evening is almost done, but have a great rest of it. And we will talk soon. Thank you, Michael, for joining us, and anyone else, let us know. See you guys next week.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.